copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Let me just dive right in and state my thesis in one simple sentence. The primary problem of our time for us in the West is that we have embraced the postmodernist denial of truth. The primary problem We have lost our faith in the authority, or more radically, in the very existence of objective truth. I would like to illustrate that with an examination of a current malady that is eating away at Western societies, namely identity politics. Because identity politics is based on a denial of truth, it is eroding liberty, limited government, and human dignity in the West. Nevertheless, there is hope. If God wills it, we as Christians engaged in the public square can be his instruments in preserving and restoring the West's civilizational achievements. So I've divided this presentation, and you'll see that in your outline if you have it up. I've divided this presentation into five sections. One, what is identity politics and what is at the heart of it? Two, what gave rise to identity politics and how does it affect liberty? Three, the postmodernist denial of truth and the loss of human dignity. After reviewing that sad state of affairs in parts 1 to 3, I would like to end with words of hope, however. First, part 4, restoring human dignity and liberty in the postmodern age. And finally, part 5, recovering the genius of democracy in the West. So first, the heart of identity politics. What is identity politics? Merriam-Webster defines identity politics as a politics in which groups of people having a particular racial, religious, ethnic, social, or cultural identity tend to promote their own specific interests or concerns without regard to the interests or concerns of any larger political group. According to Wikipedia, identity politics refers to political activities rooted in experiences of injustice shared by different social groups. Identity politics typically aims to reclaim greater political freedom for marginalized groups through understanding each group's distinctive nature and challenging externally imposed characterizations. In my view, neither of these definitions, nor any others that I've seen, really get to the heart of identity politics. The heart of identity politics is the postmodern denial of truth. The suspicion that truth is not really truth, but simply a tool to assert power. This suspicion of truth, by the way, is also at the heart of political correctness. That's why identity politics and political correctness go together. They both reject the idea that there is any truth claim that can command greater allegiance than the feelings or opinions of any individual or group, especially those that are deemed to be oppressed or disadvantaged. Reality itself becomes nothing more than what each individual or group feels it to be. Individual choice and group identity reign, and reality can and must be reshaped in the service of individual choice and group identity. Ultimately, the only thing that is objectively true is my subjective assessment of what is true for me. The only thing that is objectively true is my subjective assessment of what is true for me. Notice the following. Identity politics arises out of a comprehensive worldview. It approaches not just politics, but also human beings, human relations, and all of life in a way that puts the racial, sexual, or gender identity of purportedly oppressed groups at the center of everything. Most commonly, this boils down to three groups, the individual members of which are assumed to be in absolute solidarity with each other simply on the basis of their belonging to that group. Those three main groups are racial minorities, women, and the LGBTQ sexual orientation or gender minorities. Now that brings us to a central problem with identity politics. Identity politics asserts that everyone should see everyone else primarily in terms of race, sex, or sexual orientation or gender identity. It categorizes and separates people from each other according to those categories. And identity politics claims the right to regulate thought, speech, and opinion so that that view that everyone should classify others primarily according to race, sex, or sexual orientation becomes the only view that is allowed. And so that anyone who dares to express an alternate view exposes themselves to severe sanction. Those who have spoken out against the anthropology of identity politics have been called racist, homophobic, misogynist, xenophobic, etc. People have lost jobs, seen their reputations destroyed, lost entire circles of friends, and more, because they have not categorized human beings as identity politics does. But identity politics not only maintains that your group identity is the central, most important thing about you, it also suggests that if you belong to a race or sex or sexual orientation that is disadvantaged or was in the past disadvantaged in your society, then you somehow get moral credit for that as an individual. A person belonging to a disadvantaged group is somehow a better person than those in the majority groups. Furthermore, identity politics clearly implies, even if it is not often directly stated, that if you belong to the majority race in your society, or if you are a man or a heterosexual, then you have somehow as an individual owe deference to other groups whom your race, sex, or sexual orientation has oppressed in the past or allegedly oppresses now. All of this is a recipe for division, resentment, and social instability. A recipe for what Daryl referred to, I wrote it down in his introduction, to the social and political turmoil that we are experiencing on a massive scale. So second part of my talk, what gave rise to identity politics and how does it affect liberty? How or why did identity politics arise out of the postmodernist denial of truth? After all, postmodernism could have asserted itself politically in many different ways. Identity politics is not obviously a necessary consequence of postmodernism. It is not a necessary consequence of postmodernism. Here's what I believe. Identity politics is a manifestation of the loss of connectedness that has resulted from our postmodern age's sacrifice of community, tradition, and truth in favor of individual choice. Postmodernism asserts everyone's right to choose everything according to his or her own preferences, including to choose one's own truth about oneself, unfettered by the restraints of community and tradition. And postmodernism has been very successful. While we were sleeping in the West, it has infiltrated our hearts amid the godless darkness of our souls. Without even realizing it, many Americans and Europeans have given up on truth. Suddenly, it has become bigoted to believe that there is a truth that is authoritative and objective. Instead, truth is in the eyes of the beholder. The denial, the rejection of truth, has become the unspoken basis upon which we think. What has been the result? We've secured the right of every person to choose his own truth, and it has made us lonely. We have freed ourselves from the restraints of family, church, community, and tradition, but we forgot one thing. We forgot that liberation from family, church, community, and tradition means the weakening or loss of ties to other people. Marriage is rarer, and people marry at an older age. Divorce is almost the expected end of marriage. Childlessness is common. Families with children are smaller. And many children grow up in single-parent homes, usually without fathers. Fewer people go to church, and many churches do not offer any sort of true community of believers. That would be too restraining. Old people live and die alone, severed from family and community. It is loneliness, the fruit of the right to choose, that has given rise to identity politics. Identity politics is the desperate attempt of those who've rejected all ties of tradition to fill the holes in their souls by seeking a sense of belonging within groups that are melded together by a common story of oppression, a story that must be true, a story that makes a moral rather than a rational claim to truth. Because each group's togetherness, each group's solidarity is based on its story. So note that postmodernism and identity politics, rejection of truth, is actually in many ways a rejection of truth on a moral basis. To claim there is an objective truth is an immoral thing because it impedes our right to choose for ourselves. So in other words, it is the insistence on individual autonomy, on every individual's right to choose for himself what is true and to live exactly how he wants, that has led to identity politics, in which the individual disappears into the group. So individual autonomy has led to the individual disappearing within the group in identity politics. Individual autonomy didn't lead to fulfillment, but to profound loneliness. The false cure for that loneliness, the cure that is worse than the disease, is identity politics. And of course, each individual, while giving up her identity to the group, still insists on her individual right to choose. So it's individual to group and back to individual and back again to group. The absurdity is multifaceted and throws off its effects in a multitude of patterns and directions like a kaleidoscope. How does this affect liberty? As said earlier, when individual choice and group identity reign, as they do in postmodern identity politics, then reality itself must be reshaped in the service of individual choice and group identity. Again, ultimately, the only thing that can be allowed to be authoritatively, objectively true is my subjective assessment of what is true for me. And my subjective assessment of what is true for me must be in force, regardless of those who are outside my group and therefore do not share in my story. Why? Because my dignity is violated by anyone who does not accept my decision about what is true for me. If I am a transgender person, I must be free to use whatever restrooms correspond to my chosen gender identity. If I am a man who is in love with another man, I have a right to marry that person and to force everyone else to call it a marriage. If I want to seek a better life in another country, then it is xenophobic to support any immigration laws that stand in the way. This idea at the core of the postmodern worldview, the idea that freedom means the right to disregard truth and decide for myself what is true, proves by its consequences that the traditional idea that freedom must be anchored in real, objective, and lasting truth is correct. So the third part of my talk, the postmodernist denial of truth and the loss of human dignity. I just mentioned dignity. and how it is now being abused in order to impose each person's private choices regarding what is true for them on everyone else. Now I'd like to review in more detail the state of human dignity today and examine how closely intertwined the new human dignity is with identity politics. In our postmodern age, something radical has happened to the concept of human dignity. Though everyone talks about human dignity, and in international forums on human rights, it seems people drone on endlessly about human dignity, we in America and Europe have given up our commitment to it. We have discarded that which gave us a solid, intellectually coherent ground for human dignity, namely, the Judeo-Christian view of the human person, the idea that we have dignity because we are creatures made in the image of God. Instead, human dignity has been radically redefined to fit today's progressive secularist worldview, the same postmodern worldview that lies at the heart of identity politics. Human dignity is no longer an inviolable characteristic of every individual as a creature made in the image of God, entailing a basically unchanging human nature and an objective truth and moral code to which all human beings are subject. Instead, human dignity now means the right of every person to define and redefine himself, to decide for himself what is true, and to have that self-definition not only tolerated, but also affirmed by society and fellow citizens in law, speech, practice, and belief. This progressive redefinition of human dignity and its fundamental incoherence is perhaps best encapsulated in the famous Mystery of Life passage in the Planned Parenthood versus Casey Supreme Court decision of 1992, which reaffirmed the constitutional right to abortion in the United States. The Mystery of Life passage goes as follows. At the heart of liberty, and I think you could substitute the word dignity there, is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. The implications of this single sentence are vast. There can be no authoritative truth regarding existence, meaning, the universe, and the mystery of life. Rather, it's the heart of liberty, the heart of human dignity, to recognize the right of every person to decide for himself what's true regarding existence, meaning, the universe, and the mystery of life. This postmodern redefinition of dignity transforms the concept into the antithesis of what it was before. And it also transforms the idea of human dignity into a highly destructive idea. Let me name three of the many reasons for that, why it's destructive. First, it gives us no grounds for asserting the equal dignity of all people. After all, it is not at all self-evident outside of the Judeo-Christian worldview that all men are created equal. Why should we consider it self-evident that all people are created equal and thus have equal dignity? There are smart people and dumb people, rich people and poor people, attractive people and ugly people, healthy people and sick people, people whose minds function properly and those who suffer dementia or psychosis. Why is it self-evident that they all possess equal dignity unless we posit that all human beings are made in the image of God? Second reason this new idea of human dignity is destructive. As you may have already noticed, this view of human dignity forms the basis for the arbitrary and divisive identity politics of postmodernism. The new dignity rests not on authoritative objective truth valid for all, but on the arbitrary desires of each individual or identity group in question. Under the new dignity, human beings are divided into oppressor and oppressed and pitted against each other. Implicitly, dignity is ascribed only to the so-called oppressed. Third reason it's destructive, and just as important as the other two. The postmodern redefinition of dignity also fails to take into account the fact that human beings are fallible, imperfect, flawed. As a Christian, I would say sinful. And this brings us just to a little foretaste of the conclusion of this talk, namely that the genius of democracy in the West is that it is rooted in the truth about human nature, in the fact that all human beings are not only endowed with rights and great worth as creatures made in the image of God, they are also limited, imperfect, sinful. As we will see, democracy in the West is indebted to this very sober view of the limits of human nature, and thus of the limits of government. So now to turn to a little bit of a more hopeful message, I pray. Part four, restoring human dignity and liberty in the postmodern age. So how to restore human dignity and liberty in the postmodern age? We need to be courageously and unflaggingly, We need to courageously and unflaggingly reassert the correct grounding of human dignity, namely, the Judeo-Christian view of human nature. Here I would like to sketch the view of someone whose influence as a thinker is vastly underestimated. The Protestant reformer Martin Luther answered the question of human dignity in a way that broadly covers how most all Christians today, even secular traditionalists, view human dignity. Let me give you a rough overview, leaning heavily on Luther's classic treatise of 1520 on the freedom of a Christian. For the Germans in our group, von der Freiheit eines Christen mention, on the freedom of a Christian, and on John Woody Jr.'s essay, Human Dignity in Early Protestant Perspective. For Luther, human dignity was grounded in the equality of human beings' status before God. As he wrote, quote, "There is no basic difference in status between laymen and priests, princes and bishops, religious and secular. We all share equally in what John Woody calls a doubly paradoxical nature." Woody writes, "First, each person," and remember here, Luther is talking about Christians. Luther is talking about Christian persons here. "Each person is at once a saint and a sinner, righteous and reprobate, saved and lost, simul justus et peccator," in Luther's signature phrase. "Second, each person is at once a free lord who is subject to no one and a dutiful servant who is subject to everyone." These twin paradoxes, according to Luther, were the basis of what he called the lofty dignity of the Christian. Because salvation and freedom from bondage to sin is available to all who believe, we are all saints, regardless of earthly status. Regardless of whether we are pope or pauper, we are free lords subject to no one. On the other hand, we are all called to imitate Christ, and we want to glorify the God who saved us and serve the people created in his image. Thus, we are all dutiful servants subject to everyone. 501 years later, to be exact, and broadened to apply not just to Christians as in Luther, but to all human beings, I think it's safe to say that most of this idea commands the assent of almost every Christian, and even in secularized form, most every traditionalist in the Judeo-Christian West. Note that in its origin, this grounds not only dignity itself, but again, also the equal dignity of all. Because it grounds dignity not in the individual human being himself and his particular merits, but in the sameness of the status of all human beings before God. We are all in the same boat. We are all unworthy sinners, yet we are all worthy of salvation through faith in God. Thus, regardless of our earthly status, we all possess equal and inviolable dignity that cannot be taken away by human beings or human institutions. Some further points about this view of dignity. First, we do not have to earn dignity because we cannot earn it. This precludes the notion that some human beings, good people, let's say, deserve dignity and others do not deserve it. Second, in this view, one is morally compelled to respect the dignity of everyone else, since everyone is an image bearer of God, and at the same time, everyone, including oneself, is a sinner, lost in sin without Jesus Christ. Third, perhaps the most important point of all is that in this view, human dignity is unassailable because it is not grounded in human beings in and of themselves. Rather, as we've seen, human dignity rests on the human connection to the infinite, inestimable, unbounded dignity of God. Fourth, this idea of human dignity can still appeal to people today. Everyone of goodwill, Christians and atheists, can see that all human beings, themselves included, are both endowed with great worth and at the same time flawed. This argument can be made on the basis of experience, without the use of religious categories that are expressed in phrases such as simul justus et peccator. And every one of us must be tolerant of others, not only because we realize the great worth of all human beings, but also because we all realize that we ourselves are flawed, and that therefore we should be humble regarding ourselves and respectful regarding others. Fifth and final part, recovering the genius of democracy in the West. Now that we've established the grounds of human dignity in human nature, in our status as creatures made in the image of God, yet who are sinful and tend to abuse power, we can get back to politics a minute and talk about recovering the genius of democracy. The genius of democracy in the West is that democracy as a political project does not, as utopian political projects do, assume that human nature can be changed via politics. Democracy in the West does not assume that human beings can be changed, human nature can be changed via politics. It does not attempt to adapt human beings to the political dream. Rather, it adapts the political dream to human beings. With its separation of powers and checks and balances, democracy in the West is adapted to the way human beings are. We humans are in possession of inalienable dignity and thus the right to freedom and other human rights. At the same time, we are all flawed. We often tend to do and want bad things. Therefore, in governing ourselves, we need to apply checks and balances and separation of powers in order to keep power from being concentrated in too few hands. Because we know we are flawed, we also realize that an undue concentration of power would inevitably lead to tyranny, the tyranny of those who have too much power over those who do not. So how do we as Christians contribute to recovering that genius of democracy, that fundamental basis of sustainable democracy without which liberty is bound to disappear? In this time of destructive postmodernist fantasies based on the denial of truth, we must continue as Christians engaging our societies to pursue truth in tolerance and humility and with determination. We must learn to speak truth in a way that is compelling to people who are steeped without their realizing it in the postmodern suspicion of any and all authoritative truth claims. people whose hearts and minds have been won over by the conviction that everyone has the right to decide what is true for them. And by the same token, that no one can claim that there are objective truths that are authoritative for everyone. Our way of life in our cultural engagement must rest on this fundamental assertion. We are not creatures governed by our arbitrary choices regarding, say, our sexuality, gender, ethnic identity, or by our perceived membership in privileged or disadvantaged groups. Rather, we are all, regardless of gender, race, wealth, or national origin, creatures of inalienable dignity who have the right to self-government and the fundamental freedoms that correspond to our human nature. And finally, to repeat something in keeping with the paradoxical status of each of us as simul justus et peccator, righteous and sinner at the same time. In keeping with this paradoxical status, we must be generous toward others, and that certainly includes non-Christians. We must be generous toward others and humble about ourselves. In this cultural civil war that we find ourselves in between traditionalists and postmodernists, we need to proceed, to borrow from Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural address, with malice toward none, with charity toward all. But that does not entail timidity or indecisiveness, for we must also act with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right and to strive to finish the work we are in. Read the Apostle Paul's letter to the Romans, chapter 12. We must not let ourselves be overcome by evil. Rather, we must strive to overcome evil with good. And let me just add one thing. I think you'll note how intertwined all of this is with the gospel, with missions, with evangelization. Speaking the truth means preaching the gospel, proclaiming the gospel. And amazingly enough, the gospel applies also to the political realm, the cultural realm, any other realm of life. Thank you very much.